The following is a message of the teaching ministry of Valley Bible Church in Billings, Montana. For more information, please visit our website at vbcmt.org.
Well, it's good to be here today. Thank you for coming. Grateful for, said this yesterday, but I'm thankful for leaders who serve in Montana as well as Christ followers who put their shoulder to the task of a local church to be part of a lighthouse. I love local churches, and they're part of God's program to be able to impact different parts of the vineyard, right? Praise God. So thank you for your connection with Valley, and glad to be here. I do have a wife. We have 8 children. They're all adults now. Still part of our lives. We have 10 grandchildren. One's in the hopper. We just had a gender reveal I saw on Friday night, so it's another boy. So we'll have 6 granddaughters. The family with 6 boys, 2 girls, will have 6 granddaughters and 4 grandsons. We're kind of reversing the gender kind of a deal. But I teased about yesterday. I talked about an issue, and I said girls are headaches, but they aren't. There was a long context. I'm not going to go into it again, because I call my girls my roses and my boys are my thorns. It just is to make sure it's very clear that I treasure both parts of my family. And they're praying for us this morning, so thank you for being here. We were here yesterday, and we're talking about Deuteronomy this whole time. And we looked at a big picture session on what you need to understand the book of Deuteronomy and walk through various things, and then of the 7 sessions, 3 of them are sermonic, a sermon out of a passage, because I wanted you to see practical relevance from the book in our lives. And so we looked at chapter 4 and chapter 6 as sermons. So it was the big picture session, and then chapter 4, our incomparable God. And then we looked at the first 4 commandments to help us understand them. They're very central as demonstrating to us who God is and how we should revere him. And we'll talk about the whole issue of how that comes across today. And then we looked at the last session. Boy, my head's a mess, I guess. Deuteronomy 6, right, the second sermonic passage. Today we're going to do this session on the law and the Christ follower. What relationship or what responsibility do we have to keep the law? And short answer is, don't walk out now that I give you the short answer, that the Mosaic Law is not law for a believer. But it doesn't mean it's without value. We can learn things about God, about his value system. We'll walk through that issue because we have various views that are out there. And then we'll look at Deuteronomy 10. It's my favorite chapter in the book, and there's powerful things to say. And then we'll jump forward to the very end of the book, almost chapter 30. It's the end of the covenantal section of the book, and then 31 to 34 are things that Moses is dealing with, the transition to Joshua, and even some things about Israel's future in the near term. But chapter 30 connects to our eschatology and seeing what God is going to do. Bad news, covenant curse on his rebellious people. Good news, that's not the end of the story. We'll see that tonight, Deuteronomy 30. So thanks for being here today. We're going to look at the notes you have. Got to wake up my iPad. So the Christ followers and the Mosaic Law. Are you with me here? You have your notes ready to go? All right, so I have more information. More notes in the back. Our brother there has notes. So if you raise your hand, if you need a set of notes for this morning session. Okay. All right, so why is this such an important issue? Why am I taking the time to do this? Well, because all kinds of people talk about it. And it can show up in how they try to live life and what they expect of others and how they should live. And we want to make sure we have clarity here. So the introduction here, let me just, this is not in your notes, but maybe it is. Why is this such an important issue? Well, God devoted significant sections of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy and a smaller section of Numbers to revealing his expectations of the nation of Israel. And so what God says in his word has importance. We should understand it. We can better grasp the larger message of the Old Testament by giving attention to what God gave us. He doesn't give us junk. He doesn't give us irrelevant things. But we have to figure out what comes across and what doesn't. Second, God expected his chosen nation, Israel, to live in accordance to this law for centuries during Old Testament times. And even Christ, he was a law-observant Messiah. He was living under the umbrella of the Israelite covenant. We've called it Mosaic Covenant quite often, and yesterday I realized it's a flawed effort. It will never ultimately be successful. I would push people to call it the Israelite Covenant because it's between God and the nation of Israel, not Moses. And so since it had such massive impact on Israel, and even was part of how Jesus lived, according to God's intention, God the Father's intention, we have to understand what's the deal. Then various New Testament passages after the Gospels refer to the Mosaic Law as having some kind of a continuing impact. Galatians 3:24, therefore the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. James 2:10, whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at one point, at just one point, is guilty of breaking all of it. So we're going to come at this later again, but the law has an ongoing, I would call it a passive witness function, like it did in the Old Testament, and it testifies to God's righteousness, and it's a marker for us to, when you stack up Mike Grisanti next to God's expectations, doesn't look very good. And that's true of all of us. It drives us to an awareness of our need for Christ. Because if the law is expressing the righteousness of God as an example, that's who we have to measure up to. And so praise God, it's a tutor to drive us to Christ. And then as believers, we should desire to obey whatever God requires of us. So let's figure out what that is, and then five, there are various evangelical brethren who teach that we need to live in accordance with the Mosaic Law. So I think it has value, and you're here today, so you do too. So thank you for being here. So I'm going to ask some questions. There are times I'm going to go faster, and I'm going to skip over some stuff. I'd like to make sure I get out of here for the Q&A, so what time am I aiming for? 10. I feel safer here in the carpet because there's a trap door there that would have taking me down to the alligators yesterday. I don't have the trap door here, so. What was the time again? 10 o'clock. Here we go. So what's a New Testament Christian's, a Christ follower's relationship with the Mosaic Law? Key features, and these are kind of definitional that affect what you do with the Mosaic Law. We look down to 1C. I clipped this out of the notes because I only did things that were visual in nature to make sure you're following along. So I'm not trying to say, look at that arrow, and you're wondering which arrow is it. And so we have the Old Testament law as holistic and coherent. My point is you can't divide it into categories that have ongoing impact on how we understand the law today and how it relates to Christians. So very, very widespread, very customary. Scholars like to divide the Mosaic Law into three categories: the moral law, which continues, and the ceremonial and civil laws that don't continue. And so they're bringing the moral laws across. And I'm saying here that God, Moses, and all the Israelites viewed the Old Testament law as a coherent, indivisible document, all of it is non-negotiable. We read a verse yesterday in Deuteronomy 4:2 that all that God says and only what God says is required of you. So it doesn't get subdivided. And the law is not presented in any categories. Look at the next visual, the top part. Instead of having a pie with three parts, moral, civil, ceremonial, the law is presented by God as indivisible, as coherent, as without any categories. I mean, if you were to take a color coder, a highlighter of some kind, and you would go through all the legal passages and have one color for moral and one color for ceremonial and one color for civil, there are going to be a lot of problems you're going to have, but you're going to have a rainbow of colors because they're all mixed in. They're not presented as distinct categories. They're all presented as what God expected of his people. There isn't a secular sacred kind of a deal. There isn't a governmental kind of responsibility and a ceremonial one and a moral one. And in the end, I'm going to say, I'll throw it out now, a law that's not a moral law is not a law from God. He gave it to Israel as their responsibility of living in a way that showed his character to each other and to the watching world. And so to sort them out is not how the law presents itself. And then, cause a little more trouble here, what about the Ten Commandments? Do they come across to us as law in our New Testament setting, while the rest of the Mosaic law does not? So I'm showing here on the left side where I have no, so I don't bring the Ten Commandments across. I said yesterday, and you need to explain this, but I don't live according to the Ten Commandments. Okay. Am I an antinomian? Do I not like the Ten Commandments? My point is that I'm not going to the Ten Commandments for divine law information. But I'll tell you this right now, that the New Testament re-enunciates nine of them. I want you to understand that the Ten Commandments, like the law, is given in a time and a place for the nation of Israel as their God-given responsibility to give them a clear understanding of how they can live in a way that puts God's surpassing character on display. It had a great function. But we'll see that what God does in the New Testament after the death of Christ and his resurrection is we have the law of love, the law of Christ, the law of liberty. It's not totally different. It resonates with the Mosaic law and the Ten Commandments in numerous spots. But it is different. And we have to make sure we don't go to the Mosaic law as law, but it can be an indicator of God's righteousness and his value system that helps us understand what he values and what he condemns. And so I'm saying here, the Ten Commandments, doesn't come across as it did for Israel for us. I liken it to, if let's say Mike Grisani wants to have the Ten Commandments be law for him. I'm walking along and I think I have just the Ten Commandments, but I have this big old bungee cord connected to the rest of the Old Testament law, and I'm a few feet down the road and thunk. I'm crunched by the whole Mosaic law because it is not separable. It can't be unplugged and taken as an individual responsibility. It was given by God as part of that Mosaic law. So the right-hand circle, the Ten Commandments is this core statement of lofty divine values for God's people. And then the rest of those detailed laws are kind of like an exposition of, a delineation of concrete things that kind of spin off that divine value system. I don't try to connect every law to a commandment. There's some people that do that. I think it's kind of strained, but I do think that the Mosaic Law, Ten Commandments, the heart, the lofty statement of these core values, colors, is exposited by, is explained by. How do we live in a way that honors God's name? Those detailed laws created body to the expectations of God. How do you live that shows his value system? And that was good for the nation of Israel as part of the Israelite Mosaic covenant and on the land of promise. All laws are theological. Below those in your notes, we'll leave that slide. So I'm saying here, by the way, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, and I understand life is real, and I'm not condemning you by pointing that out. Some of my outlines, I do Roman numeral 1 and capital letter A, maybe the outline pattern you're used to. When it goes more detailed, what I do to avoid more complexities, the letter of the alphabet of the point tells you the level of the outline point. 1A, A, first level point, like Roman numeral 1. And then 2A, 3A, 4A are parallel first level points. 1B, second level point. 1B, 2B, 3B are parallel. So just so you don't get thrown off by the letters of the alphabet. So we're in 2B, we're the second level point. We have, first of all, 1B was key features about the Old Testament law coherent. Second, we have, so 1B, key features of the law. 1C, third level point, the law is holistic and coherent. 2C, all laws are theological. And this is getting at that law, that moral, ceremonial, civil category. What in the world? How can there be a non-moral part of the law? And even, what does it mean? This is not a moral law, it's a ceremonial law. So I'm saying here, in light of this truth, all laws are theological. It's difficult to determine whether a given law falls into a moral category or one of the other categories. Can a law be a theological law and not a moral law? Now, I realize for us, we can categorize them in an initial way. Yeah, this seems to address duty of citizens, and this is more of the sacrificial system, and these maybe more directly affect one's relationship with the Lord. But it's a false division if we're going to bring it across, because all of them were what God expected his people to obey and to live a life that honored his name. And then the third point is to keep in mind, under the law being holistic and coherent and indivisible, is the Old Testament law is part of a covenant between Yahweh and Israel. I mean, it's not a free-floating deal that has no historical attachment. It just is this set of law codes, and whoever wants to can live by it, and it just floats along. So he gave it at a certain point in time in a certain circumstance. As such, this law is closely associated with Israel's conquest and occupation of the Promised Land. And I talk about land being a big concept. Promised land is the setting where it happens. 4C, the Old Testament law is firmly embedded in Israel's theological history. God delivering his people from Egypt and bringing them into the land of promise is foundational to understanding what God's doing. Here's the short story, if you will, if I have any short stories. I often go too long on a given issue. Imagine that the land of promise that God has set apart for his people, and he's bringing them into the land of promise. When he brings them out of Egypt through the wilderness, plains of Moab, cross to the Jordan River, they fight with the Canaanites, and they take control of the land of promise. The land of promise is a platform of life on which they're supposed to live their life on earth, surrounded by nations. And as they keep this law in a wholehearted way, this is God's ideal, whether it happened or not, doesn't matter. As they would live their lives in an inside-out fashion, fervent, heartfelt, genuine obedience on this platform that God gives them. His intention was that they would be a testimony of who God was to each other, as well as his surpassing character before the nations of the world. So it's anchored in the what God is doing historically with God's people, putting them in the land of promise for a reason. It wasn't just like, here, have your batch of candy and ice cream and enjoy it. It's meant to be part of their function, their purpose for existence. Live on this land in a way that honors my name. You can feed, encourage each other in that endeavor. And you can impact and create thirst in the hearts of pagans around you who just have junk. Now, this is where some of the core values come across, what God's trying to do. But in this case here, because Israel didn't do that, doesn't mean that's not what God wanted. And really what that does is that paves the way for us grasping what God has always wanted from the time of creation on, that his people would be image bearers and demonstrate who he is to each other and to the watching world. And it paves the way for us understanding what he's going to do and having a promised land for his people eschatologically, and he's going to redeem them in the future. All Israel is saved, and they're going to put them in the land of promise, and they're going to all be believers. And what God wanted is going to be seen then in a much more full way. All right. Why did God give the Mosaic Law to Israel? 5C. From an Old Testament perspective, the law has a high and lofty function. Sometimes, partly because we can't see ourselves living under the law. I wouldn't vote for living under the law. I mean, just as hard. But sometimes because of Paul's and other New Testament writers talking about the law in a negative way. And they're doing this, I understand what they're doing. They're not saying the law stinks. They're saying that people who use the law as a replacement of Christ alone for salvation are using the law badly. The law was not meant for that. It found fulfillment in Christ and wasn't meant to be an operational standard from that moment on. And so sometimes you have the idea that the law was a divine torture chamber. It was a means of salvation. It was a means of racking up status in heaven. It's none of those things. Ever was. Never was. Even in the Old Testament, no one was ever saved by offering a sacrifice or by keeping law. Keeping the law was a matter of maintenance of a walk with God, finding, pursuing forgiveness, expressing your joy and thanksgiving over an abundant harvest. It was never meant to begin a relationship with God. It was always an expression of a heart burdened by sin, rejoicing in his blessing, a fellowship offering to rejoice with others at the temple tabernacle. So here's what it was. It was a revelation of God's holy and righteous character. Be ye holy as I am holy. And so when you have the law, again, and God calls us people to live according to the law, be ye holy as I am holy, of course we understand that nobody could ever do that, but the point isn't perfection, it's you're aiming at a goal. Live a life that is distinctive and set apart from sin and consecrated to the Lord imperfectly, seeking forgiveness as you need to. But it still is that. It has that function by its very nature to exist as this standard, a yardstick that is our goal, that was Israel's goal, whether they measured up to it or not. And then it's a demonstration of man's sinfulness, right? You put Mike Chrysanthi next to the law. Loser, worm, wretch, because I don't measure up. And I wouldn't in that day like I wouldn't today. And that's why an awareness of the law in cultures that have an awareness of it is convicting. The whole Kirk Cameron and what's the other guy's name? Ray Comfort. Appreciate what they do. It works in Judeo-Christian countries who know about the Ten Commandments. In a Hindu or Muslim place, it's not maybe as effective. But they walk through the Ten Commandments as a diagnostic tool to say, so how you doing? And everybody gets a 50 or below. Fail. Okay. It's a demonstration of man's sinfulness. And Doug Moo, who's not exactly like us, but he says some great things. I have a quote here from him. We have seen that both Old and New Testaments teach that the law could not free people from the power of sin. But the scriptures go further. The law has actually had the effect of revealing and stimulating sin and locking up the people of Israel. And it's the condemning power of sin. It puts them in a box. You're toast if you're going to depend on the law without intervention of God to see your need for a faith relationship with him. All right, and then it's also a divine provision. So three things. It's a revelation of God's holy and righteous character, a demonstration of man's sinfulness. And this is the one that I probably emphasize more just when I think about a Bible-wide reality. The law is a divine provision of clear and tangible guidelines to enable his chosen people to lift up his name, to advertise his surpassing character to each other, as well as the surrounding pagan nations. We looked yesterday in Genesis 1:26, 27, where it says, "Let us make mankind," I'll translate it, "as our image, according to our likeness." According to our likeness sets us apart from the animal world. As our image, it's from the get-go a function that God assigned his created humanity to be image bearers. Exodus 19, I read this yesterday too. "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings." It's a metaphor, of course, but he's saying, by carrying them on eagle's wings, you have Israel on this eagle and they're thousands of feet above the ground. Guess who's ultimately and totally and exhaustively and comprehensively responsible for getting people from Egypt to Sinai? It's God. Carried them on eagle's wings. So he's like the Ten Commandments. This is a relational front porch. He's already invested in them in amazing ways. 10 plagues, crossing the Red Sea, providing for the food and drink, getting them to Mount Sinai. "Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant," the one that's around the corner, chapter 20 in Exodus, the Ten Commandments and the following laws, "then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession, kingdom of priests, holy nation." Longer story needed, but all three of those have a representative function built into them. He's saying to his people, the reason I'm giving you this law, Exodus 20 on, is that I'm not leaving you in the dark. Obey me. Live a life of loyalty. Figure it out on your own. And I'm going to hold you accountable. No, a great, gracious, loving, merciful God reveals with clarity how God's people in Israel would be able to live a life that honored his name. It doesn't leave him in the dark. That's a gift of grace, and can't go into it, but if you understood the ancient Eastern world, that's totally absent. Folks in the ancient Eastern world had zero idea what their alleged gods wanted except to feed them. But they'd smack him in the side of the head. They expected that to happen. It just is a very different reality in the Bible. And there are places in the prophets, he says, "Am I a wilderness to you? Am I a place of darkness to you?" And the answer is no, you've revealed what you want of us. I'm Israel. They were the boneheads. All right, then moving on. Hey, you want to remove that clock from up there in the screen so I don't have to worry about it, okay? No, I'm teasing. According to the New Testament, the Mosaic Covenant is no longer a functional covenant. I'm going to read just Hebrews 8:13 there. By calling in Hebrews 8, he's talking to believing Jews in various parts of the empire, and he's explaining something really hard. Because for centuries, they were under the Mosaic, or the Israelite covenant, Mosaic law. In Acts 2, there's a quantum shift that happens. No longer nation, neither Jew nor Gentile, bond or free, male nor female. No longer Mosaic law, no longer circumcision required. And this is a tough pill to swallow for some. And so he wants to emphasize this. It's later in the game, but he says, by saying a new covenant, earlier in the passage, he quotes from Jeremiah 31 up in verses 10 and following. This is my covenant. And then he says, verse 13, talking about that covenant, by saying a new covenant, he has declared that the first is old. And what is old and aging is about to disappear. It's obsolete. It's set aside in the coming of Christ. So Jesus Christ is a mediator of a new covenant that replaced the old, the Mosaic, the Israelite covenant. Danny Hayes writes, the Old Testament law specified the terms by which Israel could receive blessings in the land under the Mosaic or Old Covenant. If the Old Covenant is no longer valid, then how can the laws that make up that covenant still be valid? If the Old Covenant is obsolete, should not also the laws in the Old Covenant be seen as obsolete? As far as having a binding, being a binding operational standard for believers today. Now, I'm going to go a little quickly over Matthew 5:17, not to avoid, there's some really good things here. I do want to make sure we get a little further here, but as part of the Sermon on the Mount, he says in verse 17, and I'm imagining he's saying this because the Pharisees are whispering around those who are following him, the entourage, Jesus hates the Old Testament. He's throwing it in the garbage. He's ignoring the Old Testament. He's trying to destroy it. And so Jesus says, don't think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets, an umbrella term for the entire Old Testament. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. He's not saying I came as my primary function to keep the law, though he did. He's saying I came to bring to fulfillment, to God's intended fulfillment, all over the Old Testament. And then he goes on and he says, but in his pre-cross setting, yes, it's important for people to keep the law, jot and tittle, and even what God's going to do in the end in fulfilling his law, he's going to bring everything to completeness. So I think what he's doing there isn't to say the law is eternal. I think he's saying that the law had its purpose. Yes, in the pre-cross setting, they're supposed to keep the law, but there's a bigger thing going on in his life and ministry. He didn't come to keep and for his people to keep for all eternity the law. He came to fulfill what God revealed in the entire Old Testament, which is going to happen. We'll talk about that with Deuteronomy 30. I wanted to get to this chart, and you have this on the PowerPoint too, but it's on page, what page do you have there? 7. Oh, there we go. Saw it in small font in my PDF. So this figure here helps explain the heart of what I'm trying to point out to you today, and then we're going to get on to how do we understand the benefit of the law for us today. So in my mind, look on the left side of this chart or whatever it is, Old Testament. Okay, in the Old Testament, we have the Mosaic law is established by God, given by God through Moses, was incumbent upon all Israelites in order to have a life that would show each other and the nations around them what God is like. Established in the old. And the Mosaic law was a passive witness. I'll explain this a little bit more in a minute. It was a passive witness to, we already said this, to the height of God's righteousness and the depth of man's sinfulness. When I say passive witness, the point is by its very existence, it says something about God's value system. Just by existing. Even if to the person who doesn't like it, condemned still, this is God's righteousness, this is your sinfulness. If you want to stay in that boat, go ahead, but it says that. And if you went to a Muslim country and you were a missionary, you still would have Muslim laws you have to live by. And those Muslim laws have something to say about their value system that's different than ours. It's just by existing. You're a U.S. citizen. You kind of have to conform your life to some of those laws, but the U.S. is your home. You have your passport. You have some protections. The U.S. is who you're responsible to. In this case here, in Israelite, whether they were happily trying to live out a law for God's life for God's glory by living according to that law to the best of their ability, imperfectly, but seeking forgiveness along the way, or they were rebellious, hard-hearted, obstinate, shake your fist in God's face, Israelite, it had the same thing to say. Righteousness of God is amazingly high. Sinfulness, you're a loser. If I looked at anybody when I said that, I'm not saying that to you personally. Okay, are you with me here? Passive witness. It has this role by existing. It's a testimony to this. Active witness function. It's an operational standard. This is how it affects life. There's a vertical dimension and a horizontal dimension. These are not like moral, civil, ceremonial categories. It's a more of a functional reality that Jesus even uses. But when you go to the Mosaic Law and you wanted to categorize them in some way that doesn't come across in a direct way to how whether they're binding in the New Testament or not, it's true. There are some Mosaic laws that more directly relate to a person's relationship with God, or say the sacrificial system, you have sanctification of priests, you have various other things that are more direct obedience to God in a direct way. And then you have most of the Mosaic Law or horizontal dimension laws. How do you deal with other people in a way that honors God's name, in a way that puts his character on display? So vertical dimension laws, more directly part of a person's relationship with God, involving primarily sacrificial kinds of things. And then horizontal dimension laws, how do you show God's surpassing character by the way you deal with the guy walking through your orchard who eats that apple or two as you walk through? Hey, that's my apple. Come back here. Now the Bible says that's okay. If you have an Israelite who's walking through your orchard and grabs an apple and eats it on the way, no problem. I mean, there are things like that. There are compassion and mercy. And by the way, if you were to take those horizontal dimension laws, and this is kind of goofy, but put them in a pot and what boils comes out to the top. What are the values, if you were to summarize these horizontal dimension laws? There are two main categories. I'm trying not to do that. I'm not sure what I'm doing. The booms? Yeah, whatever. Sorry. You have justice, equity, righteousness, what's right, kindness, and compassion. Those are generally the values that are, those little itches being scratched by this horizontal dimension laws. And why in these horizontal dimension laws do you think they all scratch that itch, one of those two itches? Well, think about the Old Testament world, which is not identical to ours, but you still had dog eat dog, me first, corrupt, do things for personal advantage people. In that kind of a world, what would be radically different? What would be countercultural? What would point in a very unique way to God's surpassing character? People who did what was right always. Equity, righteousness, justice, kindness and compassion. You know, the whole guy eating the apple through going through the orchard, or, you know, grabbing some kernels and rubbing them and eating them for a snack. Or you have the flat roof houses, and in the Old Testament time, that was a common practice. You put a parapet, you put a wall, you take the money and the time to build a wall around the roof of your house to be compassionate on the guy who's up there. You know, you're having a fellowship dinner or something so it didn't fall off to the edge and die. All those things are things that are showing part of the character of God: righteousness, equity, justice, kindness, compassion. So as a person would live according to the Mosaic Law, they would have things that were more directly related to Yahweh and their relationship with him, and others are dealing with other people, but put on display these two sets of virtues. Are you with me? I'll take questions later, I hope. All right, how about move to the right side? And in the New Testament, the Old Testament law continues as a passive witness function. And that's where it's like a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. It's still in that Old Testament, in the New Testament setting, early church, Jews is where the church started, right? Acts 2, 99.8% of the people were Jews who were there for the Passover. And then the Gentile population of the church grows. But so in the New Testament, especially at first, where you had people who had lived under the Mosaic Law, it still functioned as a demonstration of the height of God's righteousness and the death of man's sinfulness. A passive witness role. But I'm going to tell you that there is no active witness role, an operational standard. It's not law that should affect the way people lived in a direct way in the New Testament. It doesn't continue as an active witness function. There's a, think about those two dimensions in the Old Testament, the vertical dimension, the horizontal dimension. Let's look at the horizontal dimension first. Through Christ's perfectly sinless life, he lived perfectly according to God's standards, and he lived perfectly according to the demands of the Mosaic Law. Through his perfectly sinless life, Christ epitomized all that God expected of Israel under the Mosaic Covenant. And if you wanted to see what it looked like for a person to keep the law perfectly, Jesus. So it brings that to fulfillment. It was one of the reasons why Paul says that Christ is the end of, the goal of, the fulfillment of the law. That part of it, that horizontal dimension, done is Jesus, the only one who's ever done that. And then the vertical dimension, his death, burial, and resurrection fulfills every iota of what the sacrificial system anticipated, fulfilled. So when they say that the old covenant is obsolete and the new one replaces it, it isn't like fail, you know, it didn't work. No, it did what God intended for it to do and to be. It served as a guideline for God's people to know how to live a life that honored his name, the sacrificial system, so they could have an idea of how to live a life, not only by faith, begin it by faith, but then address sin and be able to have opportunities to rejoice and celebrate and all that goes with the law. In the New Testament, that operational standard, that active witness role ends, and part of it is because Jesus fulfilled it all. All the horizontal dimension laws, what do you do with other people? Perfect. Jesus was perfect. Vertical dimension laws, death, burial, resurrection, done. Brought it to fulfillment. Okay, so we're going to come back to that with questions if I can. The next chart on page 8, it may be goofy, I'm just trying to make a point here, that you look at the Mosaic Law and you look at the law of Christ, law of love, law of liberty in the New Testament, they are not absolutely diametrically different. There are differences. But the points of resonation between the Old Testament law and the law of Christ, law of love, law of liberty in the New Testament are because what? On the bottom left here, I think I have this, sorry. You have it in your notes. But the bottom left of that image, they all stem from, both the Mosaic Law and the law of Christ, law of love, law of liberty, stem from God's perfect character or the eternal moral law of God. And so, not surprising that there's some resonation between Old Testament laws and what the New Testament expects of us. But it's restated in a different way because it's a different historical, theological setting. It's the church. Nation, not. Promised land, not. Mosaic covenant, not. It's a new day, new covenant. All over the world, Jews and Gentiles, other things. And so they're believers, Christ followers, from Christ on, day of Pentecost on, have similar moral requirements, if you will, and life requirements, concrete expectations. But it's an entirely different setting, and so we don't go to the law for law. All right. The next chart I'm not going to go through for the sake of time. My boss, if you will, at the seminary, Buznitz, it's helpful, but I don't have a trap door, but I do have a clock that's ticking. Yeah, and I have a section, why should we teach or preach from Old Testament legal passages? And there's some good stuff there. I want to move on. How does one, while we're on page 10, how does one preach or teach Old Testament legal passages? There's about five or six options. I'm just going to point to two of them, and I'm not going to explain the first one as much, but a dear friend of mine, Dan Block, Old Testament scholar, and then another guy, Chris Wright, who I've quoted in some of the sessions yesterday, a UK guy, English guy, says lots of good things. Both of them would say why shouldn't I bring this law across? So then they would expect as many laws as possible to be binding today. And I'm summarizing here, but I just think that that creates some confusion in how it comes across differently than it was in the Old Testament. I do think there's more to say there, but they're out there and you can read their options. On page 11, I give you a chart or an image that we talked about yesterday a little bit, real briefly, from Danny Hayes and Scott Duvall. I prefer a term called, an approach called principalism. Danny Hayes suggests an approach called principalism that involves five steps, but it starts with this image, their town in our town. Now, of course, it's not our brother's fault of not including. Oh, no, I have it on mine here, but I don't have it on there. I added, if you notice, at the bottom of this image in the river, I have covenant. I added last night, promised land. You don't read my mind and make those changes? What in the world? No, and I didn't get to play with what you helped me with yesterday to kind of do that. It's my fault. So what I want you to see is their town, flat roofs, people in robes, Old Testament, their town, right side, our town, skyscrapers, people with dresses or pants, you know, kind of a post-Old Testament, New Testament scenario. There's a principalizing bridge that is what guides us in what might come across from Old Testament times. But there's this river that separates their town from our town that, like culture, language, time situation, I would add word covenant, Israelite covenant, and promised land as features that if something is anchored to those concepts, it wouldn't come across. Now, let me help you. I wanted you to see that. And so there are five things Danny suggests for understanding law and what would be normative. First of all, he says, grasp the text in their town. What did the text mean to the biblical audience? And I'll read from him here. Has the law you're studying been given as a response to a specific situation, or is it describing the requirements for Israel after they move into the promised land? What other laws are in the immediate context? Is there a connection between these laws? Probe into the nature of the particular law you're studying. Try to identify how this particular law relates to the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant, the Israelite Covenant. Does it govern how Israelites approach God? Does it govern how they relate to each other? Does it relate to agriculture or commerce? Like, that'd be one of those things that wouldn't come across. Agricultural practices don't have to be replicated. Is it specifically tied to life in the promised land? Now determine what this specific concrete expression of the law meant for the Old Testament audience. Identify clearly what the law demanded of them in their town. Now, Chris Wright offers a number of other questions that could be helpful as well. So, first of all, understand the text in their town. Now, I threw out an example yesterday. What about Deuteronomy, where it says it's an abomination for a woman to wear a man's clothing? Well, and today, my roots, no pants on women. I mean, that'd be an abomination. And so, but they ignore the fact that it also says it is an abomination for a man to wear woman's clothing. And of course, they wouldn't like dresses on men either, and I wouldn't either. None of my boys wear dresses. But is that the deal? Is that focusing on attire? And as I said yesterday, what did men wear in the Old Testament? Robes. What did women wear in the Old Testament? Robes. Okay. Then it's not about pants on women, right? So if we understand the text in their town, in an Old Testament setting, it's not about an article of clothing they didn't have in their day. That's not what it is. And so if we misunderstand the text in their town, whatever we bring across to our town is corrupt, is bad. And so that's why it's important. Okay, here's another example. So let's say I have a pastoral role, and, you know, Mrs. Smith comes to me with Billy. Pastor, tell me why Leviticus and Deuteronomy tell Bobby he can't have a tattoo. Well, she's not going to like where I'm going to go, but I'm not going to say have that tattoo, Bobby. I love tattoos. I'm in a personal tattoo-free zone, right? So the thing is, we have to look at where does it talk about tattoos and what's the deal? In the chapters, it talks about body piercings and tattoos. It's interesting to read the larger context. What we're talking about is a pagan worship or mourning practice. Like when you have, it's something we can see today in our media, the Shias on Jihad, on the Hajj, on the way to Mecca, they'll slice themselves, bleeding all over the place to show the extremity of their dedication. The whole Elijah, the prophet of Baal, when they're asking Baal to come and send fire to burn up the sacrifice to show he is God, nada, quiet, crickets. And to up their dedication evidence, they do stuff, slicing themselves to show their dedication. So body piercing and even body marking, when it's condemned in Scripture, is in a whole set of laws that address pagan practices. So in the end, I would say Leviticus and Deuteronomy, primarily Leviticus, and the whole issue of body piercing or tattooing, are irrelevant to what Bobby's talking about. So Bobby, what pagan god are you trying to honor here by this tattoo? He'd look at me like he's confused, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to New Testament passages that talk about our body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, who we are and what we wear, and even what we have on our body marked is a testimony for or against God's value system. So what do you want to have in your tattoo? And then why do you want to do that? What's your goal? Being conformed to the world because all your buddies have this gross tattoo? Or if the message or the motive is not according to what would glorify God, then that's why I would say Billy, Bobby, whatever, I can't remember his name was, I would say you shouldn't have that tattoo. I might have said, and I don't have a tattoo, that I could have above my heart a tattoo of a heart with Martha Ann's name in it, right? Expressing my deep love and care for my sweet wife. That wouldn't be wrong. It's not a problem. But, so I'm not saying go get tattoos, right? It just is, it's just a squishy area, years ago when we were in California, we had this one guy we kind of adopted from a rougher life, but he was at the TMU, and he would come to our house for most Sunday dinners, and he one time sat down at the dinner table and put his arms like this, and it said, you know, what is it, Galatians 2:20, for me to live is Christ. Wow, Daniel, that's interesting. When'd you come up with that idea? Oh, over the weekend, had some spare time. What are you trying to accomplish? Well, I thought it'd be kind of a conversation starter for the fellow waiters I work with. Well, I got that. That's okay. Your heart's big. It's a biblical verse. I mean, it's like putting God as my co-pilot on your license bumper, license deal. Brings with it a responsibility. Don't drive like the devil, right? Be a good advertisement for God as your co-pilot. So anyway, the point is there. Okay, so I'm going to go quickly here. No trap door, but clock is going. Measure the width of the river to cross, and that's what you're going to ask. Is it anchored in the promised land life? Is it part of, an essential part of, this covenant obligation? An if-then world where Israelites are at the center of things? Is it part of a national obligation for God's people? Well, I'm not going to bring it across because it's something anchored in that Old Testament setting. Cross a principalizing bridge. It should be reflected in the text. It should be timeless. Point is that it doesn't have some of those things that anchor it in the Old Testament. Should correspond to the broad theology of the rest of Scripture. So if your only evidence for this is in the Mosaic or Israelite covenant, and it's not reaffirmed at all in any sense in the New Testament, I would be hesitant to bring it across because it doesn't match God's value system Bible-wide. Shouldn't be culturally bound or tied. You know, like, could be a tire, or it could be how you do agriculture, or it should be relevant to both Old Testament and current New Testament audiences. There's some repetition there, but it's consult the biblical map, and then how does it fit with the rest of the Bible? It's a little redundancy there. Grasp the text in our town, and that is sometimes it'll be modified to some degree. I mean, I'll do one last thing, and then there's more we could talk about, but you know, in Deuteronomy, there's a passage that talks about in an agricultural setting that don't muzzle the ox who's treading out the corn. Now, what in the world? What is that? So in Old Testament agriculture, you'd have harvesting, maybe 2 minutes extra, harvesting the grain, putting it into sheaves, bringing the sheaves to a place where there's a flat, kind of rock-based flat floor on the hill. And you're going to spread out the grain in batches, I'm sure. And you'd have a thing called a threshing sled. It's a wooden kind of a sled. And in the bottom of it, you're going to punch in, hammer in sharp rocks, if you have any pieces of metal, stuff like that. And then you're going to have normally an ox who's tied to that sled. Maybe put rocks on it or people sit on it to give it kind of weight. And you're going to have him walk around that batch of scattered grain stalks. And he's just going to chew up those grain stalks into pieces. And then you're going to thresh. You're going to take your threshing fork and you're going to take forkfuls of that cut up stuff. And the stalks themselves are called chaff. You want to be at a place where the wind would blow, and they're going to blow away, and the kernels, which are heavier, are going to drop to the floor. So you're threshing. You're going to have to sieve it out anyway to get rid of some other stuff. But so the point is, here's this oxen you hooked up to the threshing sled. He's going around. If he puts his nuzzle down and eats some mouthfuls of that grain, don't worry. He's working for you. Don't muzzle the ox. Are you with me with the Old Testament setting? Anybody confused? All right. Well, Paul does something I didn't expect when you read it. He's talking about pastors in the church, and he says, don't muzzle the ox who's laboring on your behalf. Was he saying something about pastors? Are they like oxen? No, that's not the point. He's trying to drive home that God's value system involved. You care for those who labor in your behalf. And this is in a ministry setting, and they're worth double honor, it says. But that'd be, on the one hand, it'd be anybody, if you're a boss and you have workers, you should take care of them. It doesn't mean your job is to make them independently wealthy, but you should care for them in a way that honors God's name and is not abusive, right? So, but this one here is where Paul took a principle from an agricultural setting that wouldn't have come to my mind right away. And he takes the principle and he says, you know, it's not about grain, it's not about a threshing floor, it's not about a threshing sled, or not even about an oxen. It's about caring for those who labor in your behalf, especially those who labor in a heartfelt area of ministry. Care for them. So that's an example of people bringing across a principle. We have to be careful. If you agree with me that the Mosaic law is not law, so if the lady comes with Billy, tell him why he can't have a tattoo. The statements in Deuteronomy and Leviticus are not law. In that case, they're addressing other things. We talked about that in their town. They're addressing pagan worship morning practices. But I'm not, if I have an interpretive situation or a life situation, I'm not going to go to the Old Testament for the answer, the legal answer to the question. I'm trying to understand well, what does it mean in that setting? And if I don't know, I'm not bringing it across. It's only if it's clear, then it might be coming across. But regardless, it's a demonstration of God's value system, and there'll be various things we can learn from that. All right, so 5 minutes for questions, or? Okay, sorry. I'm sorry, folks. Any tough questions?